This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MailChimp. More than 3 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
2 weeks of shutdown, 2 days to the debt limit. Come on, who thought it would get this far? Anybody? You got to be honest now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping individuals and businesses make their best impression where people learn about them first on the Internet. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Kronos, providing cloud-based time and attendance, scheduling, HR, and payroll solutions for organizations of all sizes. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, and it is October the 15th. Those, honestly, may be the only definitive things you are going to hear about what's been going on in Washington today. There have been so many combinations and permutations of House plans and Senate proposals and what's in and what's out of any potential agreement that it's enough to make your head spin. Marketplace's David Gura has once again somehow drawn the short straw and is on this story. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
So what's in play as of this moment?
Well, a few things are, Kai, and I think the biggest is that the health care law is back on the table. You remember the health care law?
I do.
It was gone, and now it's back. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, this was all about Obamacare. Then last week, it wasn't. And now, here we are again. And I should say that the conversation isn't about defunding the law,
right,
as it was a few weeks back. It's not about delaying it either. What we're talking about is sort of nibbling around the edges of the law, making some minor changes here and there. What else is at play? Well, the House Republican plan would do away with what are called extraordinary measures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's easy to forget that we actually hit the debt ceiling a few months ago, Kai,
mm-hmm,
and we haven't defaulted because the Treasury Department has used what are called extraordinary measures to sort of move money around,
right,
so that we can keep paying our bills. The last thing in play, I should say, are dates, and that's sort of how long we'd keep the government open if the government were to reopen, and how long Congress would raise the debt limit for.
Well, hit me with it, because this is still a short-term deal, and it's actually really short.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. No matter what happens, nobody's talking about extending the debt ceiling for a really long time or for reopening the debt ceiling for a really long time. If you look at that House proposal, for example, it would keep the government open until mid-December. It would raise the debt ceiling until early February. So maybe by Washington standards, at least nowadays, these are sort of long-term agreements. But come on. I mean, we avert this crisis, and then we avert all the unknowns that would come with the default just for a couple of months. We'll be back here again having the same conversation.
And that is in part why the market started reacting as they did at the close today, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but we're not talking about really precipitous drops here, though, and at least not yet.
Yep.
And I asked Dean Mackey about that. He's the chief U.S. economist at Barclays.
I think most economists and investors in the back of their mind assume that somehow the government will find a way to pay its bills.
And believe it or not, that's still the case. That's really sort of what's driving the thinking on Wall Street, that we've been pushed to the brink before. But in the end, no matter what, if it's the 11th hour or the 11:59, whatever minute, politicians are going to find a way to get their act together. But I mean, we're getting some warnings, and we're getting warnings from ratings agencies who are saying that the U.S. is now on watch. And I think that as we get closer and closer to October 17th, which is the date on which the Treasury Secretary says we're going to hit that debt ceiling and no longer be able to use those extraordinary measures to pay our bills, that investors are going to get a little more worried, a little more skittish.
Two things. Let's make it clear that it's not like tomorrow night is the apocalypse. I mean, the government ostensibly runs out of cash flow, but it's not like something happens tomorrow at midnight, right?
Exactly. There's a squishiness to this deadline, and I should say that Jack Lew has access to more data than anybody. He knows sort of what's supposed to be coming into the Treasury Department and what's supposed to be going out. So he's place this date with some certainty. But
right.
again, what it really comes down to is how much money is coming into the Treasury Department and what bills are due. What's the Treasury Department going to have to pay? Could that happen at midnight? I suppose so. Could it happen later in the day? There's a right. chance of that. Could it happen later in the week? That could happen as well.
And you'll be here to tell us about it, right?
Short straw gets shorter.
David Gura in Washington. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Kai.
So anyway, on this whole thing about the markets and credit and what they were doing, the Treasury Department went out and tried to sell some short-term debt today. 3-month and 6-month Treasury bills. Didn't go so well, in point of fact. Demand was a bit soft, which means the yield, the interest rate the government has to pay, was a little bit higher than it has been. And in fact, big financial firms have been unloading that short-term U.S. debt for a couple of weeks now, which might mean that no matter when, and I'm going to say when here, not if, when a deal gets hammered out, the damage has already been done. From New York Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that piece of the story.
When it comes to investing, U.S. Treasury bills are not the sexy, exciting investment. They're more like the stable, dependable investment you can always count on. Until now, says Marilyn Cohen, a bond money manager.
The bloom is off of the rose, and you have Congress to thank for that.
The U.S. isn't looking like such a safe bet. Investors have become wary of U.S. debt, says investment economist Gary Schilling.
Investors have dumped these with gay abandon. They obviously are worried about gridlock in Washington.
The U.S. has started offering higher interest rates on short-term debt to attract investors. In other words, it's getting a whole lot more expensive for the U.S. to borrow money. That's only adding to the debt problem. But Schilling thinks in the long term, we're safe.
For one key reason, what's the alternative?
Big investors like central banks need a safe place to put money. A lot of money, says Cornell economist Ishwar Prasad.
There is no other place to take such large amounts of money and park them with a reasonable expectation of safety.
But bond expert Marilyn Cohen says the Treasury bond brand has been badly damaged. And the lingering message for investors is that they need to start looking for alternatives.
We are the best of the bad bunch for now. I don't know that that is going to be true on a long-term going forward basis.
Cohen says treasuries used to be safe and not very profitable. Now, if they can't offer investors safety, they'll need to offer them more money or be brushed aside. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Just to close a loop on something David and I were talking about, Fitch, the ratings people came out this afternoon and put the U.S. credit rating on a negative watch. It's not a downgrade, but it's not good. Traders today were edgy even before that, and who can blame them? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lest you think Washington and the United States have a monopoly on depressing economic news, there's always Greece to consider. The lenders that have helped Athens through its financial crisis so far now say that Greece has to find another $2.5 billion plus in spending cuts next year. There's already a tough austerity package in place over there. Pensions and wages have been cut. The unemployment rate is at 27%. The BBC's John Humphreys reports now from Athens on the economic pain that just won't go away.
You're never far from a drama, on stage and in real life. When the classical dramatists like Sophocles wrote their plays a couple of thousand years ago, they like to take their plots through hubris, nemesis, and finally catharsis. And that is just what Greece is experiencing.
Hey, nous sommes pour Gatti.
When little Eva Zagarakis was conceived, life was good. Such was the hubris of successive Greek governments. They'd been borrowing billions upon billions to buy the people's votes with no hope of being able to pay it back. Then, nemesis, the financial crisis. Eva's father, Nikos, lost his job with an orchestra. Her mother, Eleftheria, is still working, but she's not being paid.
I wish I didn't feel this fear that I will not be able to cover the children's needs and then my own. I always wanted children, and that's why I decided to have a second child. And we were already experiencing problems. But, you know, it was a way for me to confront the crisis, and maybe it's a way for me to get through it.
Greeks often tell me that they help each other, and there's something to be said for that. There's something else, too.
Konstantin Papadopoulos was a government minister and now works for Eurobank.
I'm very surprised how patient people have been, because what has happened in Greece, is, as far as I know, hasn't happened anywhere else in the world. Of course, that doesn't mean you can keep punishing them for another 5 or 6 years. Obviously not. There are limits to this. But hopefully, maybe next year will be the year when the slide downwards will stop and things will start looking up.
In the meantime, you have this extraordinary spectacle in Athens of people who are no longer paid to do their jobs, but are doing them anyway.
Sure.
I'm in the control room of one of the main studios in the State Broadcasting Corporation's headquarters. It's an enormous building. Thousands of people worked here. At least, they did, until 2 months ago, because these people shouldn't be doing what they're doing. They're not even being paid for it. They were all sacked, and the whole place was closed down. The screens went blank. And the people here said, well, tough, we're not closing down, we're staying put. And they did. And here they are. It's the most bizarre situation. Well, the program's just come off the air, and I'm outside the studio. Yanis is just coming out of the studio. He's one of the presenters. Yanis, nobody in the control room there, in the control gallery, is being paid to put the programme on the air. Are you being paid?
No.
You're not being paid.
So it's the obvious question. Why are you doing it?
Because it's very important, not for us. The problem is the Greek people.
It's for the people of Greece?
Yes, of course. So we must stay here. I will stay here.
Yeah.
For my daughter. I can say to my daughter that we haven't money, but I can't say that we haven't democracy. Democracy is more important than money.
The Greek drama, the Greek tragedy, as many here call it, is not yet in its final act. Catharsis is some way off. What may be reassuring is that the most dire prophecies have not been fulfilled.
The BBC's John Humphreys reporting for us from Athens. When the Wildcats of Northwestern University kick off against the Minnesota Golden Gophers on Saturday, there's going to be a slight change at Ryan Field. No peanuts in the concession stands. Northwestern is holding its first peanut-free day, aimed at making life just a little bit easier for fans with allergies. Marketplace's Noel King looks at allergy economics.
Mike Poliski, a spokesman for Northwestern, said the idea for peanut-free day came from a concerned parent.
We received a phone call from a very passionate father,
whose son is an incoming freshman with a peanut allergy. Peanut-free day isn't free. Concessionaires at Ryan Field sell a lot of bags of peanuts each game.
It's somewhere in the 1,500 to 2,000 range.
And 50,000 seats need to be hosed down to make sure they're free of peanut residue.
Power washing is involved, I know that.
But Poliski stresses that for Northwestern, money isn't the issue. Peanut-free days have been cropping up in professional and college sports stadiums lately, and some airlines don't carry peanuts on certain flights. So are peanut growers, sellers, and shellers taking a hit? Marty Kanan says no. He's president and CEO of King Nut Companies, which supply snack nuts for some North American airlines.
We also have product offerings that are nut-free, so snack mixes, fruit mixes, and trail mixes. So we've grown as a company because of the need to have some peanut-free items.
And Sherry Coleman Collins with the National Peanut Board, a marketing organization, says sales of peanuts and peanut butter continue to grow.
Well, people love it. You know, peanut butter and peanuts are foods that we know are nutritious, and they're affordable, and they're delicious.
Northwestern's Poliski says the school might try another peanut-free day, maybe even during basketball season. But the salty snacks will be back in concessions next week. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we make this very sharp distinction between candy and food that is good and wholesome. And yet, when you just look at the chemistry and the molecules, the substance of it isn't all that different.
Do not tell my children. But first, Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 133 points today, 0.8%, ended at 15,168. The NASDAQ sank 21 points, about 0.5%, 3794. The S&P 500 fell 12 points, 0.7%, closed at 1698. Citigroup shares dropped 1.5% today after the bank's earnings fell short of expectations. Teradata Corporation, which sells data storage software, erased 18% after its earnings missed predictions. FLIR Systems, that makes thermal imaging devices for surveillance, lost nearly 14% today for committing the same earnings sin. FedEx says it's going to buy back 10% of its shares, and that worked today, at least in the markets. FedEx shares gained 4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Delta Airlines, introducing 100 new 737-900ER planes for more economy comfort available across Delta's fleet. Delta, keep climbing. By the University of Maryland Smith School of Business, with faculty and research centers that put academic thinking into action. rhsmith.umd.edu. And by CEB, helping executives put the right people in the right roles with SHL talent measurement solutions. More at cebglobal.com. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its latest Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And it's National Boss Day. Send a card. Hey, I'm not telling you what it should say. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are in, though it may have escaped your notice, the thick of literary awards season. Last week, the Nobel Prize for Literature. Today, the Man Booker Prize over in the UK, which went, as it happens, to a New Zealander. Tomorrow, the National Book Award finalists are announced here. This year, though, some of those big prizes have been revamped to help the business of books. Audrey Quinn has that story.
3 years ago, things at Bellevue Literary Press were looking pretty bleak. Bellevue's a small New York publishing house, and it was about to go under. Then publisher Erica Goldman got some surprising news.
I'll never forget, I was in my office, and we got a call from the AP.
It was a reporter on the line. A book Bellevue had published, Paul Harding's novel Tinkers. It had just won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction.
I almost fell off my chair in shock. It took several months, actually, to get over the shock.
Tinkers has now sold 500,000 copies.
The success of that book, because it won that prize, has kept us afloat ever since.
She says Bellevue wouldn't have made it without that Pulitzer. And even bigger publishers say the industry needs these awards. They sell books. So literary prizes are broadening their appeal. Up until this year, the Man Booker Prize was only open to authors from England and British Commonwealth countries. Now, as long as a book is on British bookstore shelves, it's eligible. Which means an author from the U.S. can win the Man Booker.
By including Americans in this prestigious award, they will get more American attention in the marketplace.
That's Ian Crouch. He writes about publishing for The New Yorker. He says literary awards may be following the movie industry's lead.
In the last few years, the Oscars increased the amount of films that they have up in contention for Best Picture.
The more films that get nominated, the more films that get a sales boost. And the National Book Award is doing something similar. It's putting twice as many novels on its nominee list.
And in each case, it was an idea to sort of engage a wider segment of the population, more fans and more followers.
And hopefully more sales for American publishers. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Ask people who do education policy in Tennessee, and they will tell you that that state has a college problem. Not enough people going, to be just a bit more specific. Only about a third of working-age residents have a college degree in Tennessee. In some counties there, it's less than 10%. Money's a factor, sure, but for some, there's an even bigger barrier. They just don't see the need. WPLN's Blake Farmer reports from a place where nearly everybody graduates from high school and few go any further.
It's college day at Hickman County High School. Seniors get the word over the intercom. Head to the gym.
You'll be down there for about 45 minutes, and then we'll allow our juniors to go. Thank you.
Recruiters from public universities like Middle Tennessee State and Tennessee Tech, along with a few private schools, have set up shop at tables covered with brochures, water bottles, and keychains. But college is a tough sell here. Even though Hickman has a 92% graduation rate, for most of its students, high school is where their education ends.
I mean, it's our life. We can do what we want.
Senior Kevin Brown says his parents want him to at least learn a trade like his older brother did.
Because they don't want me to be a bum, but I don't think college is for everybody because you can go and waste a lot of money and not know what you're going to do.
Money is a real issue in this rural county outside of Nashville. Roughly half the students come from poor families. Hickman principal Philip Jacobs says there are lots of scholarships and aid available, but what's really missing is a good push from mom and dad.
If the parents are sending one message and the schools are sending another, then the student's going to take the easier of the two paths.
Jacobs speaks from experience. He graduated from this high school in 1990. He was the first in his family to attend college. He says in his house,
it was never an option that we wouldn't be expected to go on.
Back then, many of his classmates went straight to work in one of the few local factories making Levi's jeans and buttons. Today, Jacobs still hears students say they plan to go straight to work. He asks, where?
Those things are gone. They're not coming back. And now what do we do next? I don't think a lot of our folks have latched on to this idea that education is the way out of that.
But creating a college culture where there isn't one isn't easy. Mae Rawson is a local hairdresser who worked at the Levi's plant before it closed. She snips away as she talks about how her five kids followed her lead from high school straight to work. It's a common generational cycle.
They was just ready to get a job and make some money so they could buy them a car and, just didn't think about college.
Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam has launched a multi-year campaign to try and change that thinking. The goal? At least a two-year degree for more than half of working-age adults.
This is really becomes, like everything else that's really important, a moral challenge. It becomes important for us to say that we won't accept having a percentage of our population that gets left behind.
But for some, not going to college is a conscious decision. Christy McCaleb owns a flower shop on the town square. Her daughter will graduate from Hickman this year.
I could push and I could pressure her and say, hey, you got to go to college. If that's not what she wants, she's not going to put forth the effort. And, you know, why go?
McCaleb says she's willing to make the financial sacrifice to put her daughter through school. But she points out that leaving for college is a decision that carries extra weight in a place like Hickman County. There's not much to do with a college degree if you want to come back home to live near family and friends.
You can't make money peddling around here.
While raising expectations for students sounds like the easiest fix to bump up college-going rates, it may also be the hardest. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
As we inch ever closer to Halloween, candy, of course, comes to mind. Lots of candy, which is, parentally speaking, terrible, right? Cavities, obesity, the list goes on. But that list might not actually be fair. Samira Kawash is the author of a new book called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure. Samira, thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
This is a little bit sideways, but you have clearly spent a number of years of your life writing this book about candy. You have a candy blog that is voluminous and detailed. What's with the candy?
Well, you know, it was really my secret pleasure and my secret vice when I was a child.
And not only that, but that nobody's really talked about it. The candy business has been a huge part of food processing in America. So I was really startled to find that nobody cared enough to look at that with a critical eye to think about how has it become so important in American life? And also, where do these kind of positive and negative feelings come from historically?
Well, it actually goes to a thing that you get to. I mean, this is a story of industrialization and globalization and all of that stuff. But you come back at the end of the book to what for me is the payoff pitch here. You can't separate candy from talking about all the other things that we eat.
Well, I think we make this very sharp distinction between candy that is harmful and dangerous and food that is good and wholesome and nurturing. And yet, when you just look at the chemistry and the molecules, the candy just isn't that different. I mean, look at the apple juice. Look at the breakfast cereal. You know,
Eggo waffles, you talk about, right?
There you go. Yeah. It's really the substance of it isn't all that different. And yet, we seem to really need to have a category of stuff we eat that we can say unequivocally, that's bad for you.
It comes about, candy does, just the general category, as a matter of convenience, right? They wanted things that wouldn't spoil or rot. It could be taken and transported to school or work easily, right?
Well, yeah. The most important thing that happened for candy from the perspective of the consumer was mass manufacture. Mm. Candy went from being an expensive, rare, luxury good to being something that was common and ubiquitous and cheap. But people didn't eat candy like it was common and ubiquitous and cheap because they saw it as a luxury good. So the candy industry had to figure out how to sell this thing as something people would eat every day.
And it becomes almost recession-proof, right? I mean, when times are bad, you want something that's going to make you feel good, and there's nothing better than a candy bar for that.
Well, it makes you feel good, and it doesn't cost much. And I think that's the boon and the bane of mass-manufactured candy. And in part, its inexpensive nature makes it maybe a little bit too appealing that we sometimes overindulge because it seems like such a trifle.
Is this an American phenomenon, not fixation, that's too strong. But, you know, we like our candy in this country, we do. Can you say the same thing for the Europeans and for Asians and South Americans?
Well, I think we are not the biggest candy eaters. I think that Scandinavians and even the British eat more candy on a sort of per capita basis. But we seem to have the most tortured relationship with our sweets. We are much more likely to use words like guilt and temptation and indulgence. Those are uniquely American worries that really draw on this long tradition of food moralism that I think is also a uniquely American phenomenon.
So just to be clear then, I am not the worst parent in the world if I give my kids a jelly bean or a candy.
I think you should give your kids a jelly bean or a candy bar, but you should also give them an education about what it is that you're giving them, and that candy is a treat, and that we need to learn to tell the difference between candy and real food, and eat real food for dinner, and eat the treat for the treat.
Got to have your kale, and then you can have your jelly beans, right?
There you go.
All right. Samira Kawash, her book is called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure. Samira, thanks very much for your time.
It was a pleasure.
Marketplace is supported by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, using a patient's DNA to customize cholesterol therapy at vanderbilthealth.com, the promise of discovery. By Constant Contact, offering small businesses online tools like social media, event, and email marketing from one login. Learn more at constantcontact.com. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the importance of branding once again becomes crystal clear. There is in Washington, D.C., an organization whose job it is to lobby for lobbyists. Seriously, not making this up. It's called the American League of Lobbyists. But as we know, lobbyists don't always have the most favorable reputation. So the Washington Post reports the group is going to rebrand. It's going to be either the Association of Government Relations Professionals or, going way out on a limb here, the National Association of Government Relations Professionals. Yeah. Our brand is Marketplace. That's the show for today. The Dow off 133 points, 0.8% as a deal continues to elude Congress. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 12.7%. Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, John Ketchman, Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM, also a brand.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.